So we're at Vanderbilt University with Owen Jones, who's a professor of biology and of law here at Vanderbilt, and with René Marois, who's in the Department of Psychology, professor of psychology here. And you guys worked on a paper together. Now, what I'd like to hear is the genesis of this and see how it all intersected. Now, you're co-director of the MacArthur Neuroscience and Law Program. Was this subsequent to that? Was this an initiative generated by the MacArthur
Well, it overlapped with it a bit, but we actually got together about a year or two before the project was kind enough to be funded by the project. We had thought that if any place should be doing law and neuroscience research, we should get involved in that, and we started exploring topics that we might investigate with functional magnetic resonance imaging, which is a field in which René is an expert. And we relatively quickly settled in on the idea that we'd like to learn something about the brain activity underlying the decision about punishment, both whether or not a person should be punished and then how much that person should be punished. So we worked for about a year or so on experimental design, and it was around that time that the MacArthur Foundation was kind enough to offer us and a number of other colleagues some funding to explore law and neuroscience projects.
All right. So how do you start thinking from your background, your perspective, use of fMRI, and so on, when somebody comes up with a social decision-making issue like how is somebody reacting to punishment issues?
I think there were two major factors that led us to do this study. The first is because this is such a central part of the legal system, is, you know, these third-party decisions are central to the criminal justice system. So for us, it was a way to tackle a core principle of the legal system. So that was one. The second, which was very important to us, is because the project built on prior neuroscientific studies that look at second-party neuroeconomic decision-making, essentially context in which there are punishment being made between two players, so that one of the players may retaliate by punishing the first player for some kind of transgression that the first player has done.
And within this whole spectrum are things like the ultimatum game.
Exactly.
Where people decide how much money to give and so on. And this is
exactly
attempting to assess whether people are going to be happy or unhappy with their responses and so on.
So the idea is that there was a very strong neuroscientific basis using these paradigms like the ultimatum game. And for us, essentially, it was a way to build on this already groundbreaking work so that we can look at the brain mechanisms involved when we do a third-party punishment decision relative to the second-party punishment systems that people have been studying in the past. So it was important that even though we were breaking ground into a new direction, you know, the legal field, to start from a very strong neuroscientific framework. And that project allowed us to do it.
So third party and second party. Could you just unpack that a little bit?
So a lot of the previous studies to which René is speaking were about a situation in which you yourself are injured or harmed by the action of another individual. And so a lot of these economic games that have been studied in the functional magnetic resonance imaging context were of that sort. You and I are in a situation in which we can split a certain amount of money, and I don't think you're treating me fairly, so I have the opportunity to punish you with some retaliatory act. So it's really a potentially retaliatory context. The law, of course, isn't in the business of retaliating. It's in the business of having third parties who are disconnected from the transgression make a judgment about whether or not somebody did do something, and in fact, if they did and that thing is prohibited, whether or not they should be punished. So we were trying to come at this from a completely different angle, which was one central, as René mentioned, to the legal system.
So this is a juror presented with the evidence of a case. Do they perceive this as being fair behavior or an unfair behavior?
In essence.
Or a judge,
exactly. One of the things we had to decide early on was how how narrowly to investigate this phenomenon. Mm-hmm. We decided in this first paper, the one you mentioned, to use this as an opportunity to gain a window into the phenomenon that we could then parse in increasingly granularized and particularized ways. So this first study really asks the subjects to behave as a combination of judge and juror. So we give an action, and the individual is tasked with deciding how much to punish the protagonist in a scenario. And that, of course, assumes the antecedent question, which is whether he should be punished at all, which typically in our American system we bifurcate between the jurors who decide the whether question and the judge who decides the how much.
Now, I understand that your position would, we have this whole battery of tests and experiments, this experimental literature is building up. Now we're talking about the possible future, somewhere down the line, applicability in a legal system. Did that give you pause? Did you think that was a perfectly reasonable thing to be doing? Did you?
Oh, yeah, I thought it was definitely a field that is worth exploring. This is something that we discussed for about a year before we decided to settle on one issue. And the legal system, as Owen mentioned, these core aspects of the legal systems are certainly have been with us for a long time, and they're really an important aspect of how our societies are built. And it seems that if we want to understand human nature and how we interact and are able to live in societies, it includes how these social norms are established and maintained. And that includes, therefore, how these are enforced, which is what the legal system is all about. So studying that field is studying a lot about, you know, the social creatures that are humans. And for us, for me, this is a very important enterprise.
Yeah. Now, it's a point that I raised with Owen, and I've raised with other people as well. And I hope this isn't too esoteric and in business, but, I mean, I've got some... whenever a new technology starts, there's the people who are hugely enthusiastic and think it's just wonderful. And then there's the people who say about fMRI, well, it's just like neophrenology. It's just an advanced kind of... And then there have been these critiques. So that I've seen papers come in that said, seeing is believing. Here's a paper. The effect of brain images on judgments of scientific reasoning. Another paper called The Seductive Allure of Night Neuroscience Explanations. You show them an fMRI in a courtroom and it's got all these bright colors and so on, and people go, oh, that must be right. And then you have the statistical critiques that came out from names that wouldn't mean much to a general audience, but Ed Vall, Hal Pashler at UC San Diego, which came to be known as sort of the voodoo interpretation of stuff. And then there was a critique of whether the fMRI was being oversold and being hyped. Has that settled? Has the dust settled on that? How do you view it as a leading professional in that field?
Well, fMRI is still a relatively young technique. It's a very sophisticated technique, very complex. We're dealing with a massive amount of information. And the field is still evolving in terms of the best way to analyze the data, for instance. And through its evolution, there is always new inputs that suggest some refinements in the way of using that technique and interpreting the data. And the papers that you're that you're alluding to are just a step in along that direction. There's clear evidence with fMRI that you can get pictures of brain functions that are exquisite, in revealing aspects of brain mechanisms that we already know in the visual cortex. So it really has a strong track record, but it still is developing. We're still searching and trying to optimize its technique. So a degree of skepticism is good and can only help moving the field forward, but it certainly is moving forward.
Yeah, so I mean, you hear reports now of people being able to look at a neurocognitive signature, if you like, in an fMRI and predict what word somebody's about to utter. I mean, that's fairly remarkable, mm-hmm. I would have thought. So how do you see the field developing and intersecting with the law? Rene, yeah.
So this is a lot what the MacArthur Neuro Law Project is about. So we have a lot of discussion onto this. One aspect is using fMRI in order to understand better how legal decisions are made, and that's some work that we've been involved with. But there are also a lot of work that is being discussed over there is having to do with understanding more of a criminal mind and understanding how decisions are made in that context. And Owen is more familiar with that work, so I'd like to hear your opinion on that.
Yes. So the important thing at the intersection, I think, is to have neither too much optimism nor too much pessimism. So we think that these techniques are going to help us learn more about potentially things having to do with criminal responsibility, maybe having to do with the ability to predict recidivism, that sort of thing. That's the promise, and one hopes that it may ultimately be fulfilled. At the same time, it's really important to maintain a healthy skepticism in the face of some of the exuberance about these techniques. And that's in part because the techniques tend to focus principally on average brains, and the law, on the other hand, is principally interested in one brain at a time. Similarly, it's fascinating to see from these studies, under very, very carefully controlled conditions, how the brain is operating in one state or task compared to another. But at the same time, the legal system is really interested in a much more ecologically rich and valid circumstance, which is difficult to control at anywhere near the same level of detail. So trying to figure out how to use techniques that enable us to learn about human brains in a way that would enable us to further a legal system which often, although not always, cares about one individual's brain, is part of the great challenge in bridging these two disciplines.
So, in a situation where you use a phrase like use a word like or a concept like trust, during the meeting that we were both at, there was one of the participants was talking about the fact that his daughter had a medical problem. And he was frustrated in not being able to figure out exactly which advice to take, because there's advice coming from all sorts of directions. Different people, different machine results, different this and that and the other. And he finally asked a slightly seasoned medical practitioner who also had a child what they would do in the same situation. They looked the guy in the eye and kind of felt that he trusted the response. If we can transpose that into a courtroom, and I don't want to sound like a sort of grumpy old Luddite, but is there going to be a time when people say, well, the machine's not telling us anything that I can't really figure out for myself, just using my innate human sensibilities and capacities in social cognition, and switch your machine off?
Yeah. Well, this is I think this is an excellent question, and it comes up, for example, in the context of lie detection. Some people have been, depending upon who you ask, they've either been exploring or hyping the extent to which fMRI may be useful for lie detection, right? So I think probably the way to approach this is to always ask the question, and neuroscientists always ask this question too, which is, where will the brain imaging provide some added value beyond what you could already discover through various behavioral techniques, whether they're laboratory techniques or courtroom techniques? And I gather that we would not even be exploring this intersection if we were comfortable thinking that the courtroom context is a sufficient crucible for truth, that we don't need anything else. And I think there's always a felt need that we do need some other things. These are things that we shouldn't necessarily assume will answer our questions, mm-hmm. but they might help us in our various deliberations, whether we're trying to understand what might have been in a person's mind at the time he or she committed a crime, which is, of course, an essential aspect of deciding how much a person should be punished if they did.
Now, remind me of what's going on at the moment. You mentioned Kent Keel, mm-hmm. with whom you are working on a future paper, right? And he's been subject of a couple of stories, cover piece in New Yorker and other places, goes around with an fMRI machine to prisons and gets scans of to explore the psychopathy, right? So psychopathic brain, see whether there's some clear markers. Is that roughly accurate?
Roughly, yes.
Right. So my understanding is that there's a current case that he's much associated with, but the actual scans were not allowed into court as evidence.
I think I know the case to which you're referring, and I'm not sure whether that decision has yet been made. There are some that may have happened and then others that are still percolating at the moment. But what I can say as a general matter is that there have been a number of contexts. I don't know if Kent has been involved with many of them, and I don't know for sure if this is the same one you're thinking about. But there have been a number of contexts in which judges have refused to allow scans in altogether, typically at an evidentiary hearing stage. One side says, this is the evidence we would like you to allow us to submit to the jury, and the other side says, here are all the reasons why it's irrelevant.
And the reason I'm asking about this is that I gather that nevertheless the results of or a descriptive version of what was on the scan was allowed in, or a PowerPoint was allowed in.
Ah, yes. Now I know.
And I'm wondering if this is the fear of the paper I cited earlier, which was that as soon as you put up the bright shiny objects with the colors, juries go, oh, well, that must be right then.
Yes. So,
because that's science.
Yes. Now I know which case you're referring to. That was a case in which neuroscientific evidence was allowed in, but not through the actual images of the defendant. And the balance, I don't know the judge's thinking in great detail, but I can venture a guess that the balancing here that is typically done is between the probative value of the evidence on the one hand and the potentially prejudicial aspect of the evidence on the other. And there has been some thinking, although interestingly, through the Law and Neuroscience Project, we've been probing the actual empirical evidence underlying this, but there has been some thinking that jurors will over-attend to visual images of a defendant's brain and will assume that if they see something that seems to be out of normal, they will then make the leaps of logic necessary to conclude that that part of the brain influenced this particular action on that particular day, and therefore this individual should not be held accountable, or perhaps alternatively should be held accountable, but not at a very high level of responsibility. So this is something that the legal system is already grappling with. Even before we or others got involved, attorneys were getting in the business of having scans done, sometimes on death penalty appeals and that sort of thing.
Help me out here. Isn't this what it's supposed to be for? I mean, wouldn't you be looking at a scan of, never mind whether it's a psychopathy case, just for in doing routine scans on attention or whatever, you'd be looking for areas that lit up as being preferentially descriptive of some activity that you were searching for, right? I mean, so isn't that exactly what you would hope to be the case, and therefore isn't it odd that it would not be used for what it was supposed to be used for? I mean, do you see what I'm...
Well, I think that one important issue is something that Owen was referring to. We're talking about individual cases. They are so, in science, primarily right now in the field, we're interested in the average brain. How does, at a group level, does the brain look like it's working? And there are extensive individual differences in brain anatomy and even furthermore in brain physiology. And it's therefore difficult to just take one particular case and bring it to the courtroom and make very strong statements about that individual case, given the status of the field right now and to how much we know about the average brain, if you want, let alone the individual differences that are still not very well explored from a scientific point of view. So I think that the importing some of these individual case data will likely be even more relevant as we understand better not only the average brain, but also individual differences in brain function through scientific studies.
So you don't even have enough of a database, as it were, to even know what a deviation from the norm is, because you don't know exactly what the norm
is. Right, precisely. And so here's an example. There was a case in New York in which a fellow killed his wife. Seemingly strangled her and then threw her out of a window. And on brain scan, there was an arachnoid cyst, something that you can point to on the screen and say, this fellow has this thing. Perhaps he shouldn't be held accountable for his action. You know, sort of a concrete evidence of temporary or perhaps persistent insanity or right. That sort of thing. And part of the problem there is you have no idea how many people are walking around unscanned who have exactly the same brain condition and don't throw their wives out of the window. So it is this sort of baseline problem, which is why it's so hard to know something about individual cases. I mean, the same is true with respect to death penalty appeals, in that somebody's been on death row for many years, you scan their brain, and you find a feature. Well, you don't know whether the feature was there at the time they committed the act. You don't know whether being imprisoned caused the feature. And even if the condition were present at the time they caused the act, you have no idea whether or not there was a causal relationship between the two. So on the one hand, we wouldn't be working in this area if we didn't think there were really some concrete and exciting things to study about the intersection of law and the brain. On the other hand, it's important that that the cart not get too far ahead of the horse here, and that we don't think it's appropriate for people to be assuming that this is just some sort of new magic box that you just stick somebody in and you can, you know, it turns on red if they're lying and now you can convict them. It's certainly not going to be that simple.
Do you sense, though, that on the one hand you're looking at averages and so on, but do you sense also that this might be a tool that becomes the basis for an improved science of individuality?
Absolutely. I think the field is going towards that direction. There's a rich amount of data of trying to understand all our individual differences in how we act, how we think, that we will be able, and I have started exploring with a technique like functional neuroimaging. I think that this field has a bright future in that level.
Yeah. It's just interesting challenges, exciting time in the sense that on the one hand you have this individual, on the other hand, the moment you sort of introduce individual brains into a courtroom, you're saying, well, maybe on a certain day it wouldn't have done that, and so on and so forth. It just seems such a tricky area to navigate, and I wish you well in exploring it. I look forward to seeing the next paper as well.
Yes. Well, some of our next papers that we're working on right now, just to sort of highlight what we're investigating, we take the same protocol that we used in the paper published in Neuron, and we're investigating whether or not judges who are actively on the bench, not while we're scanning them, obviously, but who are active judges in their careers, have a different neural activity when they're making punishment decisions than lay people. So that's one of the things we want to investigate, is essentially the different thinking that legal education and legal experience may or perhaps may not may not provide.
Well, now that's an interesting tack, because let me just sort of invent stories. Let me just tell just so stories from it, just for the heck of it, as I'm rolling along here. Suppose it turned out that judges had more, I think we even heard this at the meeting, more bilaterality in their decision-making circuitry, shall we say. Would that mean that they were more even-minded? Do they learn how to be more Solomonic, or might they have some actual Solomon module? Because I can imagine a newspaper at some point saying, judges have innate Solomon module, you know. Can you help me out with that stuff?
Right. Well, we don't know yet whether or not ultimately there will be differences that are statistically significant, whether it's a function of bilaterality, whether or not they're using their more deliberative regions of the brain differentially compared to their more emotional parts of the brain. That's still very much an open question. But I think it would be very interesting to know, given the debates that take place periodically in law, about whether or not judges should be deploying their emotions in making Solomonic determinations about punishment and that sort of thing, whether they do so any differently than average human beings. It's a little bit like knowing whether or not doctors are more empathetic or less empathetic at the end of their medical training than they were going in or than they were when they started their career. So,
is there anything on that, by the way? Do you know? I mean, have they become more?
Yes, I'm afraid I don't know the actual findings on that, but I think there are people who study precisely these sorts of issues. So what we're trying to do here really is not so much anticipating that, well, we'll give somebody an injection and they'll become a much fairer decision maker, but really we're just sort of investigating at the initial frontier of the brain. How is it that people go about engaging in precisely these decisions about which so much has been written, about which so much attention, on which so much attention has been focused? What actually is happening? This might give us a window, in the same way that opening up the chest cavity to learn about the heart gives us a window into what the process actually is. And although we don't know exactly where that will lead, it seems to be one of many prerequisites to having a deeper understanding about the phenomenon in a way that might ultimately lead us to learn more about what things influence decisions and ultimately what things might bias decisions. If we're worried about just, fair, and effective decisions, and we're worried about undue biases and prejudices, as indeed all the evidentiary rules are, we might want to begin at this point with these new techniques investigating the underlying phenomena that these rules are designed to try to manipulate.
When you go ahead.
Well, so another thing that I think this research is very informative about, it's not only what it can do or say about the legal system, it also what it can say and do about the human brain and the human nature. I mean, so many societies have a third-party punishment system, some kind of, you know, criminal justice system. It's been suggested that the evolution of human societies depended on the implementation of a third-party punishment system. To the extent that our brains reflect a good approximation of an optimization of the world in which we evolved in, then it's likely, therefore, that there are some mechanisms that have developed or to favor these kind of third-party decisions. So, to a lot of extent, we can learn a lot about human nature. About, are there, for instance, brain mechanisms that are more specific for making punishment decisions, or are there differences between third-party and second-party punishment decision-making, for instance? I think that this whole field of social neuroscience, of which I think this is part of, can reveal a lot about the human brain as well. And to me, as a neuroscientist, that's fascinating. It's not only the legal aspect, it's what we can learn about the brain and the human mind.
Well, that's great. It's fun to have this intersection. We're going to go on and have another longer conversation, Renee, about the neuroscience, but let me thank you both. And I'd like to come back at some point and see how you find out about judges in future and whether, in fact, that they can learn wisdom.
Thank you for having
us. Jones, Renee Marois. Thank you very much.
Thanks.